This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Tab Hunter was a Hollywood golden boy whose looks propelled him to stardom.
Beautiful California surfer, handsome, that every single girl or boy would want to make out with.
That's a clip from the documentary Tab Hunter Confidential. A lot of people know Tab as the frequently shirtless star in movies like Battle Cry and Damn Yankees. But this film shares a lesser-known side of the story. It documents his take on 1950s Hollywood and illuminates what it was like to be a young, closeted gay actor at the end of the big studio era. The documentary is based on the 2006 autobiography Tab Hunter Confidential, The Making of a Movie Star. The film is screening this weekend and next week at the North Carolina Gay and Lesbian Film Festival. We'll get a preview today. And joining us now is Chuck Adams, Executive Director of the Tab Hunter Autobiography. Chuck, welcome to The State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much. And let me just clarify, I was not executive director. I was just an editor.
Editor. You don't direct books.
No,
do you?
No.
You can direct them, but they don't do what you say.
Exactly.
They just kind of sit there on the page. You edited Tab Hunter's autobiography, which served as a jumping off point. Tell us a bit about how you came to meet Tab Hunter.
Well, I've worked in publishing the better part of my life, and I was in New York City for a great part of that. And I got a reputation of being able to work with difficult people, i.e. celebrities, and I got assigned to work on a lot of different memoirs by high-profile people. And I met Tab in the course of that. He was brought to me by a writer who was planning to work with Tab on the book. And when I met Tab, I loved him immediately. I'd been a fan of his when I was young and when he was a big star. And so I knew he had a great story to tell, and he convinced me that he was really going to tell it. So I took it on and worked with him, and we ended up, I left New York and moved to Chapel Hill to work at Algonquin Books, and we brought the book with us.
You, Tab had never really spoken openly about his situation before, had he?
No, he hadn't. He had been, I wouldn't say so much closeted, as just, he's very private. Yeah. And he said, I don't want to be known as identified by my sexuality. I want to be known as an actor. And that I happen to be gay is just an aspect of my life.
So take us back. Tell us that story about Tab Hunter, the actor in Hollywood.
Well, as you'll see in the documentary, which I've had the pleasure of screening part of that now, he talks a lot about being discovered, and because he was exceptionally attractive and thrown into a world where there were a lot of attractive men, but they were all being put up for sale kind of on the screen. It was an era when marketing had changed from trying to attract housewives and mothers to go to movies to get teenagers to come. And so they started putting Beefcake, as they called it, on the magazine covers. And Tab was one of them, along with Rock Hudson and James Dean and many others that became stars. It's just a matter of the fact that they really weren't actors yet. They were just beautiful people. And Tab was serious about trying to become a real actor and really, really wanted to learn. And he had, unfortunately, had been arrested once at a party that was raided by the police because it was gay.
Why don't we listen to a clip from the film right now?
Nobody could take their eyes off Tab Hunter. He was the all-American boy, and nobody sold that image better. He was the good-looking sailor. Or he was the good-looking Marine, or he was the good-looking Air Force pilot.
I did so many military films that I was waiting for the government to send me a pension. I mean, my gosh, I was in uniform all the time.
Yeah, so here's a guy, again, but largely posing in these films, right? I mean, and he wanted to act. What did he tell you about that, about sort of being taken seriously as an actor or not being taken seriously?
Well, I think he found it very frustrating because he was serious about wanting to be a good actor. I think he also recognized the fact that when he started, he really wasn't a good actor. He had a lot to learn. And he was frustrated that they kept putting him in parts that were really just an excuse for him to get his take his shirt off and put his arms around a beautiful girl. Natalie Wood, for example, starred with him in a number of movies, and I think he really wanted something more. He wanted to stretch, and they weren't really willing to take him seriously.
And this was a time, again, this was the studio system where the studio had enormous control over the actors' on-screen and off-screen life, or persona anyway, if not their lives.
Right. Everything was kind of dictated to them. Their private lives were closely watched and monitored and controlled in many ways.
Well, let's take a listen to another clip from the documentary where he talks about his personal life and keeping that sheltered.
I would never discuss my private life with anyone. I was able to get close to them, but I never really went that deep in the relationship. I had the ability to live behind this wall. And you only allow people to break the barrier if you feel you can confide in them and you want to have that friendship.
That's a clip from the documentary Tab Hunter Confidential. It's screening at this year's North Carolina Gay and Lesbian Film Festival in Durham. Chuck Adams is with me, who worked on the book, the autobiography. Why did he decide to talk about his private life? It was years later, of course.
I think what really prompted him was he heard there was a book coming out about an agent named Henry Wilson, who had discovered Tab, basically, and signed him up first, along with Rock Hudson and Guy Madison and Roy Calhoun and a number of other hot-looking men that of the time. And I think Tab wanted, he felt if his story was going to get out there, he should be the one to tell it, not somebody else. So I think that's what prompted him to do it.
You talked about, again, that sort of the world of Hollywood and the way Hollywood itself would, I mean, the studio itself would cultivate an image. He tells a story about a double date that the studio set up to make, to protect his image. Tell us that story.
Well, he was always going out on dates very publicly to nightclubs and to like the Oscars or something like that, always with a beautiful girl on his arm. And at one point, he was involved with the actor Anthony Perkins. They were having a relationship, and he and Anthony Perkins went out on a double date with a couple of women and got photographed, and then they went back home to Tab's apartment and spent the evening together. So
paparazzi got what they wanted, and Tab and Anthony Perkins got what they wanted. And again, this whole sense of being trapped in your image. It will take another clip from the documentary that takes a look at sort of how he was feeling at the height of his career.
Tab's been out of town for a while. Now he's back, just horsing around, waiting for the day he's discovered again.
I was very concerned. So I bought space in Variety to just tell people, hello, is there any possibility of getting a job somewhere around here?
I just wanted people to know that I wasn't dead, that I'm still alive.
And a couple of responses, really sweet people said, yeah, get lost, or yeah, drop dead.
Tab Hunter, who was every high school girl's idea of a dreamboat. He was a boy who never seemed to get any older. Well, he has.
Well, I might as well have been a relic from the silent era, because people wanted real people in real situations, no more Hollywood made-up personas.
A clip from the documentary Tab Hunter Confidential, screening at this year's North Carolina Gay and Lesbian Film Festival. Chuck Adams is with me, who worked with Tab Hunter on his autobiography, on which the film is based. Was that pretty much it? It wasn't so much his sex life that did him in. The fact is, things were changing, and people weren't looking into that kind of weren't looking for that kind of actor anymore.
Exactly. It was all about his face and his appeal to sexual appeal, and not so much about the talent. As I said, he wanted to stretch beyond that, but they just never got the opportunity.
What was it like to work with him?
He was great. He was very, very nice and very forthcoming. I was working with a writer who worked with him, and so I would go back and ask him to talk a little bit more, tell me a little bit more about some things. And every now and then he would pull back and say, I really don't want to go there. You have to respect that. But I found him very easy to work with.
You worked with a writer, but not with the first writer that Tab Hunter had chosen, I guess.
No, that was an awkward situation. The first writer that Tab had chosen was a friend of mine, and I'd done a number of books with him, but he really was not a particularly good writer. And Tab's partner came to me after we had lunch together and said, have we made a mistake? And I was truthful. I said, you've made a mistake. So they fired that writer and hired another.
talking with Chuck Adams, who was an editor of Tab Hunter's, the editor of Tab Hunter's autobiography. And we're also talking about the film Tab Hunter Confidential. Jim Carl is with me today as well, senior director of the Carolina Theater in Durham. Been involved with the North Carolina Gay and Lesbian Film Festival since the beginning. Jim, welcome. Good to
welcome.
Have you here.
Thank you so much.
Tell us about this. The festival itself has really been around for two decades, but tell us about its origins, because you were there at the start.
Well, I was there when the first official festival occurred in 1996. What a lot of people don't remember is that the previous year, in 1995, there was a film series. What had happened is that the North Carolina Gay Pride March was happening in Durham, and they came to the Carolina Theater, which had just reopened its doors after a major renovation, and they asked the theater staff at that time, would they be interested in hosting a film series in conjunction with Pride March? And the theater said yes. So that first year, it was just a film series. And when people remember a lot of the controversy about the festival, they're really just talking about that first series. It was a success. And so after that, the theater decided, well, let's make this an annual event. And so the theater put together the first Gay and Lesbian Film Festival in 96. And you're right. I've been there since the very, very, very first festival. I was there in the projection booth.
Tell us about the controversy. Hard to imagine a controversy over a gay and lesbian film festival in Durham, but maybe 20 years ago, a very different place.
It was a very, very different place. I remember it got so bad in the media. You have to remember that in 1995, after the theater had just opened, the theater had no identity at that time. It wasn't what people think of the Carolina Theater in 2015. There was no branding there. The city had spent a tremendous amount of money restoring the building, but they really didn't know what to do with it. The theater, was it going to be a live events venue? Was it going to be a film palace? Was it going to be a rental facility where we're going to house an artist, you know, like the Durham Symphony? So when this happened, a lot of people in the Triangle who were misinformed believed that their tax-paying money was going to fund a gay and lesbian film series, which was not the case, but that was the perception in the public. And again, it was the 90s. It was 1995, and the mainstreaming of the queer culture had not yet occurred as it has today. So a lot of people were very taken aback that this new facility, which has been getting all this media attention, is suddenly producing this gay and lesbian film series. There were protesters. There was a lot of people who were worried that the content of the films that were being screened that first series were pornographic, which they weren't. So, of course, in order to quell some of that controversy, members of city council were brought into the theater to screen the films in advance of the series to, I believe the quote was, determine whether they were immoral. And
oh, there's a joke in this, and yet I can't.
Yes.
But there's a thousand jokes. Yes. Insert joke here. Well, tell us about your involvement, too, was kind of almost accidental. I mean, you were an associate at the time and suddenly found this thing in your lap. Tell us that story.
I had just moved to North Carolina and was hired at the theater in October of 1995. The series took place in June of 95, so I remember watching the TV coverage and wondering to myself, what is this organization that I'm starting to work for? Who are they? But so the first festival was announced, which was going to be in August of 1996, and I was the assistant back then to the director of film programming. Well, the committees met, they selected the films, and about 2 months before the first annual Gay and Lesbian Film Festival, the director decided to take a job in South America. So the higher ups at the theater came to me believing that, well, I had been his assistant, obviously I know what's what's going on, and asked me to take the reins on the first festival. Now, you have to remember, I was 26 years old at the time. I had never been to a film festival. I had never programmed a single film in my life. I had worked on film sets before when I was in college.
So you work cheap. That's one thing.
Well, it was a necessity back in those days.
He has no resume. Let's not pay him.
Thankfully, nobody else at the Carolina Theater in 1995 had ever been to a film festival either, so I didn't have to worry about job experience. But it was, as I've told people, I just really didn't know in those days how to put a festival together. What went into putting a festival together? How do you book a film? Somebody literally handed me a phone and said, start booking things, kid. You know, call the filmmakers. You know, book what?
Well, now 20 years later, it is there will be no protest. It will be welcomed with open arms here in Durham. And tell us about the festival. How has it grown?
Well, over the last 20 years, the attendance, of course, has just kept increasing. The number of submissions, and by submissions, I mean the number of film entries that we receive each year from filmmakers and distributors from around the country and around the world, has increased dramatically. This year, we had over 800 submissions.
Wow.
And of those 800, 150 films were selected for this year's festival, and that's 150 shorts and features. But those 150 films will be screening over in the 9-day period from August 14th through the 22nd. And we've got so many great titles this year. But what I guess going back to your original question, over the last 20 years, attendance has just skyrocketed. The attention that this festival has gained on a national level, I always tell people that there are three stages of this festival, having been with it for 20 years. The first stage was in the early 90s or the late 90s, where people would say, distributors would say to me, where is North Carolina? Then as we moved into the early 2000s, the phrase was always, well, there's this quaint little, very hospitable festival in North Carolina. And now by 2015, the catchphrase is, we have to screen in North Carolina.
Chuck Adams, what's it like for you to see the book that you edited now as a documentary film?
Well, I'm excited to see it because I loved the book and I wanted to see Tab's story told more broadly than it was with the book. And I know how much time and effort they put into doing this, so I'm thrilled for them.
It is one of the many films that will screen at the North Carolina Gay and Lesbian Film Festival. I want to thank both of you for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chuck Adams joined us to preview Tab Hunter Confidential. He edited the autobiography. And Jim Carl is with us as well, the director of the festival. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wadarski sat in today. Andrew Tyes, our intern. Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.